Today we'll have a rebroadcast of an early New World Notes, the 10th installment from April 2008. It features me and Dr. Michael Parenti, and it's called War, Language, and the Media. Welcome to New World Notes, a series that explores the gap between the America we want and the America they're trying to make us settle for, and how we the people can reestablish our commonwealth and reclaim our democracy. Edited by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. Today we'll take a look at war, the media, and language, specifically how the news media promote war through their use of language. Both what they say and how they say it. Leading the way on this will be Dr. Michael Parenti, one of the best progressive speakers today, and certainly the funniest. We'll also hear some good music, and of course my own unique blend of obscure references and highly debatable commentary. So if you know what's good for you, stay tuned. You know, I used to teach English composition to college students in eastern Iowa. And there, the campus and the downtown commercial district were cheek by jowl. There was a popular bar and restaurant called the Airliner, right on the border. The Airliner was maybe 85% bar and 15% restaurant, but they had good curly fries. As recently as the early 1980s, states retained their right to set their own minimum drinking age, and in Iowa, it was 18. I was a bright young whippersnapper of an assistant professor and one of the nation's leading practitioners of what I called the epistemic approach to teaching writing. In fact, there were about 11 of us in the nation, so I guess the entire movement consisted of leading practitioners. We were interested in the way that a composition of language, a story like this, for instance, amounts to one way of seeing things, and how an alternative language creates an alternative way of seeing things. Not just reflects this different way of seeing, but creates it. Hey, isn't that what education is? Or at least psychotherapy? Discovering new language that gives you a new way of understanding things. Little did we realize, the 11 of us and the maybe 39 students who could make any sense out of what we were professing, little did we realize that we had tapped into one of the key weapons of the GWAT, the so-called Global War on Terror, which we didn't have back then, of course. Perception management, quote-unquote, is one of the key weapons of the U.S. side of this war. And how do you manage perception? By manipulating the images the public sees and, just as importantly, controlling the language available to the public to make sense of things. Think of two groups of citizens who fought back against invaders. In France in the 1940s, these rebels were called the Resistance and celebrated and aided by forces of the United States. In Iraq, such chaps are called not the Resistance, but the Insurgency. Also called dead-enders, disgruntled Baathists, and now, more and more, just terrorists. Needless to say, now they are not patriotic heroes, but the bad guys. A new language makes a different sense of what's essentially the same thing. Here's another example of alternative language creating alternative understandings and opening up different sets of questions. What are we conducting in Iraq? A war or an occupation? If it's a war, who exactly is the enemy? And how will we know when we've won? Or perhaps lost? On the other hand, if what our Marines and mercenaries are doing is not a war, but an occupation, why have so many hundreds of thousands of people died? Why are we arming the populace, Kurd, Shia, and now Sunni alike? Why is the whole country a shambles? 5 years after Saddam Hussein was removed from power, why is the U.S. still occupying the country? Recall that in the 1940s, Germany occupied France and the U.S. occupied Japan. Neither France nor Japan was badly damaged by their occupation. Some would argue that Japan was much improved by U.S. occupation. Nobody but nobody says that about Iraq. What's going on? More language. Pentagon spokespeople have taken to calling everyone the U.S. Army kills in Iraq a terrorist or else Al-Qaeda, including 4-year-old girls and their grandfathers. Gotta hand it to Al-Qaeda. If they can get 4-year-old girls to sign up, they're doing much better than the U.S. Army. We should torture some of their recruiters. See how they do it. Possibly Al-Qaeda doesn't take back your enlistment bonus if you get injured on the job and have to withdraw from the conflict, like the U.S. Army does. Meanwhile, back in Iowa City, I sent my class of sophomores down to the airliner bar, telling each person to write a pair of descriptions of the place. Each description of the pair had to be true, each had to be full of specific factual statements, and as objective as possible. But one description had to make the place seem attractive, the other unattractive. A third part of the assignment asked students to reflect on what they had just done, writing the two descriptions, each true and objective, but giving opposite impressions of the place, and then explore on paper what it means to write something objective or unbiased. Well, the reflective third sections were all pretty bad, but many of the description pairs were marvelous. One student did an especially nice job. I still remember that paper. One of her descriptions of the airliner mentioned the free popcorn. Another mentioned the burnt, greasy, oversalted popcorn. One mentioned the laugh-filled conversation of the half-dozen young people seated behind the large front window. The other quoted the moronic remarks of these people. Coming up is one of my favorite historians and speakers, Michael Parenti. He talks about how the press, both newspapers and TV news, pull the same stunts my students did, not in order to learn something, but to manipulate public belief in support of established power. Parenti talks about the media's way of naming things, particularly about the use of what he calls disinforming euphemisms, like the word reform, as in welfare reform or Social Security reform. We might add the word terrorists. He also talks about the stories the press decides to cover, the stories the press decides not to cover, and the stories the press tries to prevent being covered. Parenti gave this talk in the early 1990s. Way back when the president was named George Bush, Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney were in high positions in the government, and we were fighting a war in the Middle East. Ah, the good old days. But first, let's have a song. Here's John McCutcheon with a relevant song, followed immediately by Dr. Michael Parenti.
Heading home to San Diego, they could almost see the dock. The USS Abe Lincoln was returning from Iraq. They were thinking of their loved ones, they were thinking of a home. Of the many sad and lonely nights on the battlefront alone. He stepped out on the flight deck in a fighter pilot suit. You know, dress up can be fun, make believe is cute. But I wonder what they wondered as they surveyed the scene after all they'd been through, after what they'd seen. 'Cause life is hard, times are tough, when the going gets too rough, and the truth's just not good enough. Let's pretend. Yeah, let's pretend I fly an airplane. Let's pretend I fought in war. Let's pretend I wasn't AWOL for 16 months or more. Let's pretend I know exactly what you folks are going through. Let's pretend that everything I say is absolutely true. Life is hard, times are tough, when the going gets a little rough and the truth's just not good enough. Oh, let's pretend, let's pretend, let's pretend. And let's pretend Iraq is grateful. Let's pretend they waved and cheered. Let's pretend this whole damn thing isn't getting too damn weird. Let's pretend we found some weapons. Let's pretend we caught Saddam. Let's pretend this doesn't feel a bit like Vietnam. 'Cause life is hard, times are tough, and when the going gets just a little too rough, and when the truth's just not good enough, let's pretend, let's pretend, let's pretend this is a solo. Pretend affirmative action had nothing to do with me and Yale, and the fact that despite three arrests, I never went to jail. 'Cause three strikes and you're out is for losers and for jerks, for guys who have to fight in wars, for guys who gotta work. 'Cause life is hard, times are tough, and when the going gets a little rough, and when the truth is just not good enough, let's pretend, let's pretend, let's pretend, let's pretend, let's pretend, let's pretend, let's pretend. Ah, mission accomplished.
You've all heard about Bosnia, haven't you? Who hasn't heard about Bosnia? Raise your hand. Ah, see? Right back there. You could leave. Okay. How many has heard about Mozambique? You've heard about people dying in Bosnia. You've heard about people dying in Rwanda. Well, in Mozambique, there was something like 1 million people died. In Angola, there was something like 3 million in wars that were being fought, financed by the CIA. Not a word about it. The massive killings and slaughters that went on by mercenary forces throughout the country, the atrocities, unspeakable stuff, it went on for years. Within a six-month period, 600,000 people killed in Angola. Not a word about it. Of course, the media didn't talk about it. So you see, they may not predetermine what you think, but what they do is they can prefigure what we think about. We talk about those things. Maybe not exactly the way they might want us, but they seem to set the agenda for what we believe is important. And when you ask about all these other issues, they'll say, well, look, you know, we have a limited amount of time and space. We just can't cover everything. We have to be very selective and careful, and we've got to compress and condense things. Isn't that right? Haven't you noticed that selective, compressed, and condensed story just recently about the Heavenly Gate cult? Right? Wasn't that compressed and condensed? It was only about a week of 24 hours a day. We had interviews of relatives, of friends who knew somebody who had been close to someone else who was in the cult. Interviews of stock boys who worked in stores where cult members had shopped in, they think, you know. Right? I mean, really, this is the media that doesn't have enough time to cover everything. And they went on and on and on about these things. Meanwhile, not a word about Mozambique. One of the ways in which the media serve as the stenographers for power, or the mouthpieces for power, is the way they so eagerly and quickly, as if on cue, demonize a foreign leader who might be targeted by U.S. military intervention. I'll give you three examples in recent years. By recent years, I mean from the 1980s and 1990s. Gaddafi of Libya, Noriega of Panama, and Saddam Hussein of Iraq. Now, what those three leaders had in common is, in their quite different ways, were charting a rather independent course for their country. These three guys were demonized within a matter of weeks, you know. Gaddafi, I remember, Libya. I'd go around talking, people would be Gaddafi and Gaddafi, and what about Gaddafi, what about Gaddafi, Gaddafi, Gaddafi going to get your mama, Gaddafi under your bed, watch out, Gaddafi. I say, what are you preoccupied by Gaddafi? There's one reason you're preoccupied by Gaddafi. Not because he's a threat to you, but because the media has been pumping you with stories about him. 2 months ago when they weren't doing this, nobody was you weren't talking about Gaddafi. You were going to bed, going to sleep, had a nice night. You didn't worry if he was under your bed or not. Now you're Gaddafi, and when they stop talking about him, you'll stop worrying about him again. It's kind of scary. So you turn to your fellow Americans, you say, how could a country, Libya, a country with which a short time ago you couldn't even find on the map, headed by a guy whose name we still can't all agree on how to spell or even pronounce, with a population of 3 million, and a ragtag army of 50,000, how can that country be a mortal threat to the survival and interests of the United States? It's not a mortal threat to us. He was a threat to the oil companies, that's all. For half a century, the CIA has been involved in drug trafficking. They were involved with the Golden Triangle. They had a whole airplane company. It was called Air America, wasn't it? Air America. It was a CIA-run airplane company directly involved with taking the heroin out and bringing it to that big, rich American market. And they had Air America flying it from those hill country Hmong tribes and these others who were supposedly anti-Vietnamese, anti-communist, and they were our allies. I mean, that's a matter of public record, for Christ's sake. Senator Church's committee discovered that in the 70s. Congressman Otis Pike's Joint Congressional Committee in the late 70s. Senator Kerry's committee in the 80s about cocaine from Latin America. Again, the CIA involved. Heroin from Afghanistan. The CIA was involved with that. I know that. You know where I read it? I read it in a secret document. You know what the secret document was? The Washington Post. Right out there, splashed right out there on page 23, paragraph 42. It said, the CIA supported war is proving successful against the Soviets. The Mujahideen are coming back and taking over their lands. And with this, the opium trade has increased. And we can expect an increase in the heroin that has flooded in American cities. I said, wasn't that interesting? Just written like that, as if it was a weather report. Can you imagine if that was the Sandinistas doing that, or Libya? Well, Cuba, my God, it would have been all over the papers for years. Here it was on page 23, paragraph 45, as a couple of sentences. Now, this is all, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, this is all a matter of public record. Three congressional committees have had the guys come forward. Felix Rodriguez comes forward before the Carey Committee and said, how much did you handle? He said, I handled about $10 million in cash a week. Said, who with? Senator Alphonse D'Amato. D'Amato's elegance and form and style. Says, wow, who with? What'd you do that with? Said, well, with the executive and military leaders of Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, Colombia, Venezuela, Mexico. D'Amato said, how'd you get out of those countries with that kind of money? How'd you get past customs? Really, Senator, when you're carrying $10 million, you don't go through customs. You know, they have limousines and helicopters waiting for you. And they say, I mean, I saw all this. I saw these guys get up and say, yeah, we got on these planes and we flew down there with guns. And then we loaded up with cocaine and we came back to the city, came back to the U.S. The interesting slip there, the city. This is a story that's been pretty much buried and killed in the media. Gary Webb of the San Jose Mercury News just this past year, again, after a year's investigation, this is journalism at its best. This is journalism at its best. Found CIA operatives who said, yes, we worked with Crips and Bloods inner city leaders in L.A., brought the crack in there and took the money out for the CIA. He put all that on the internet, by the way. It got around so much. And look what the media did. They came out and saying, there's no evidence for it. There's never been any evidence for this. I mean, just outright blatant lies. Three congressional committees have given you all the evidence in the world. And the media comes in, and when their first line of suppression doesn't work, and the first line of suppression and distortion, the most common line, is omission. You just don't report it. When that doesn't work and the story gets out, gets on the internet, or some other thing happens, or there's demonstrations, or congressional committee decides to discuss law, then they come out and they destroy the target. And they say, Webb is not a particularly good journalist, this, that, and that. He has no evidence for it. He thinks the whole CIA, they accused him of having said things he never said. That's the way the media worked. Listen, if that kind of thing went on in some countries, that would be called totalitarian control. Senator Church found that every major news organization and outlet was penetrated by the CIA, that some 400 journalists, editors, and publishers were connected to the CIA. 400, that's a goodly number. There's a massive assault on government human services programs, and this has been given relatively little play in the media, except when it's doing the government's bidding. For instance, the word that's out is that certain things need reform. Welfare needed to be reformed. Now notice the use of certain terms, too, reform. These are the disinforming euphemisms that are used. Welfare wasn't reformed, it was savaged. It was destroyed. I mean, if I come over to your house and I say, you know, your house needs some rehabbing, needs a little reform, and then I level it with a bulldozer, I mean, wouldn't you be piqued? Wouldn't you feel deceived? And now we hear that same word again, Social Security. We've got to reform Social Security. Why, in 15 years, it'll be bankrupt. It's a lie. But they convince people, they, from the beginning, say, well, this is going to happen, and therefore we've got to change it. The truth of the matter is that Social Security is a program that works, and it works very well, and it works for you too. The media begins by assuming the argument. The very thing that has to be argued and debated is already assumed. And they say, well, we all know that it needs reforming. We all know that it isn't working. It's working perfectly. In 50 years, they've never missed paying out a check. They handle $300 billion a year. And it means the difference between destitution and some measure of dignity for millions of elderly people and hundreds of thousands of disabled people. You'd never know that from the way the media treats that subject. Percent of the reporters I run into, and journalists and editors and such, they're the ones who get very indignant that you suggest that they are influenced by anything other than their own discerning, independent insight, you see. Are you telling me that I'm not my own man? I'll have you know that in 20 years with this newspaper, I always said what I like. And I answer, you say what you like because they like what you say. And you have no sensation of being repressed because your views are perfectly coterminous with those of your boss. Your unexamined assumptions, your use of terms like reform and swamp rat and whatever else are exactly the kind of stuff they want to hear. It fits. Your ideological perspective is theirs. So you don't have any sensation of restraint. Nicholas Johnson gives the case of the four stages of the socialization of a journalist. In stage one, the young, dedicated, idealistic reporter goes out and he investigates something and he writes this expose about local power guys who also happen to be big advertisers for the newspaper. And he comes back and he shows it to his editor and the editor says, no, that's silly, we can't do that. No, that won't fly. Stage two, he doesn't go out and write it. He gets another idea about something that should be looked into, but he goes talk to the editor first and the editor says, no, forget it, forget that. Stage three, he gets the idea and then he dismisses it himself and says, nah, that's silly. And in stage four, he no longer gets the idea, no longer critically looks at that. And I added stage five. Stage five, he gets on panels with media critics like me and gets very indignant if I suggest that there are influences on him and all that.
Earth was dying if they said this on the news, if they would clarify the picture instead of seeking to confuse. If you could see the ice caps melting, if you could watch the oceans rise, if you could see the consequences right before your eyes. If you knew the kids were dying, if you could look inside the river where their food comes from, filled with cyanide. If you could hear the parents pleading, if they were looking right at you, if you could see the anguish in their hearts. What if you knew? You knew knew the bombs were falling, if they showed them hit the ground, if you could see the bodies flying, if you could hear the sound, if you could see the rubble where the hospital once stood, if you saw the child's lifeless limbs, would you hold them if you could? If you knew that they were lying, every time they spoke, for every laser-guided pinprick, there were lives lost in the smoke. If instead of just the generals, they had doctors too to describe the carnage of the cluster bombs, what if you knew? You knew what they were saying when they think you cannot hear. If you understood what they do, if for you it was so clear. If you knew they shut down the factory in an economic ruse. If you could kiss the cheek of the child in the sweatshop that made your shoes. Every time we went to war to fight our evil foes, they told you we were really fighting for the good of CEOs. If you could feel the hunger of the many, see the riches of the few. If they told it like it is, what if you knew? You knew that you were living in a huge conspiracy. Would you leave your suburbs, get out of your SUV? Would you hit the streets and fight for all our lives? Would you hold your ground when the stormtroopers arrive? If you knew that the whole planet depended on what you do now, would you take command with the speed our times allow? If the pundits told the truth for just a week or two and real life was shown on TV, what if you knew?
Ending up with a little David Rovix there, and thanks for listening. For the Michael Parenti talk, our thanks to Sally Soriano and People's Audio Video. The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the presenter, the station management staff, or the licensee, and their expression is protected by the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Your comments and suggestions are most welcome. Write to Kenneth Doust, New World Notes, WWUHFM, University of Hartford, 200 Bloomfield Avenue, West Hartford, Connecticut, 06117. Or email me at kdoust, that's K-D-O-W-S-T, at hotmail.com. Until next time, from the spacious underground studios of WWUH, here's wishing you a good week. Illa get to my non-carborundum. Try to speak the truth and keep the faith.